Thank you. Glad to start off the day with a die of log.
Absolutely.
Maybe your day started 4 hours ago. I don't know.
No, I had to take the kids to school.
Yeah.
Today's my oldest boy's 17th birthday,
Oh, great. Congratulations.
Making me feel very proud of him and very baffled about myself. How in the world did I get to be so old?
Well, I think we're exactly the same age, but all I have is a six-year-old. I took her to school this morning, and we had a long conversation about impeachment and the Constitution and how that worked and so forth.
Well, that's very advanced of you.
Yeah, it is very advanced. I emailed my wife about that, and she wrote back, and she said, "I'm glad you two have each other to talk about this." Yeah, she was interested in that. She said, "Okay, but if they impeach George Bush, you get Dick Cheney." And I said, "Well, yeah, but then, you know, if they wanted to, they could impeach Dick Cheney too, and then Nancy Pelosi would be president." And she thought that would be cool. And then she said, "But I realized the problem with this whole thing, George Bush makes the laws. He could change that law impeachment." So then we had to go into the Constitution.
Excellent.
Anyway, and I try not to load her with too many political biases.
Yeah, I try to do the same, but I'm sure they leach out.
So,
speaking of being baffled, conservatives are baffled these days because they've had one of the most sort of precipitous reversals of fortune that you can think of in a long, long time. I was reflecting back that the period between 2004 and 2006, right after the 2004 election, there's a spate of books coming out, Why Conservatives Have Become Invincible.
Right.
And now, just 2 years later, they started a spate of books of, you know, why conservatism is falling apart and why it was doomed from the start. And the only thing I can think of in any kind of analogy, at least in my lifetime, is the space of time between 1964 and 1966. After the 64 election, the LBJ blowout, you've got liberalism triumphant, Goldwater's conservative movement just an electoral disaster. And then, you know, 2 years later, a big resounding victory for Republicans in the midterm elections and the beginning of the crisis of liberalism that really never abated and from which liberalism hasn't really fully recovered. So whether this is just a blip for the right's fortunes or whether it's truly a turning point and whether this is just a wrong turn for the right or whether this is a destiny that was long in the making, those are all questions that are on lots of people's minds these days. And I know you just did a review of a book on this subject. Maybe you can talk about the book and your take on it.
Right. Well, maybe you'll back up a little bit before I come back to that, because I did a review of a bunch of those books about, you know, like Tom Edsel's Building on America and a book called One Party Country by a couple of LA Times reporters, you know, which are still interesting books. I mean, they're kind of like reading about the techniques of some, you know, hedge fund genius right before the hedge fund collapsed. It's still interesting to know what they were trying to do.
Right. Those buzz stories about how great Enron was.
Yeah, exactly. And you often see it when there's, you know, a formula that's a little too good to be true. It really, you know, the seeds of the disaster are completely built in at the moment of success.
Nothing fails like success, they say.
Right. It is remarkable to think, I mean, right after the 2004 election, beginning of 2005, that was right around the time I moved back to Washington. And, you know, I went to a meeting where basically, you know, knowledgeable former members of Congress, Democrats, Republicans, absolute agreement that, you know, Bush's plan on Social Security was going through.
Yep.
And the only question was whether he would also be able to push through some, you know, massive tax overhaul.
Right.
You know, and that was just an absolute given. And yet you could actually feel right there that they hadn't done any of the things that actually gave you the mandate to do that. They held the power without, you know, and the game had all been about, you can do as much as a 51 with a 51% mandate as you can with a Reaganite mandate of 1984.
Yeah, well,
that's
a characteristic vice in this town is overinterpreting events.
Yeah.
So, and we may stray into that this morning.
Yeah. Well, good. That's what you know. How would we fill an hour of blogging heads without it?
Yeah.
But you know, so now it's really turned, and there's an interesting phenomenon going on the debate going on mostly on the left, I think, which Greg Anrig's book on the called The Conservatives Have No Clothes on the sort of general failure of conservatism, Paul Krugman's new book as well called The Conscience of a Liberal, are all part of this overall effort to say, you know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we thought it was all about George Bush. Bush lies, Bush, you know, breaks the law, Bush,
right.
Bush,
right.
Rove, maybe, Cheney, maybe.
Throw in delay there,
you know,
right, yeah.
We had this group of villains, and now there's sort of an effort, and it feels like a little bit of an effort to sort of close off the escape hatch.
Yep.
Which is to say, you know what, it actually wasn't the idiosyncrasies of these individuals. There is actually something deeply wrong with conservatism from the beginning.
Right.
So that the idea that the Bush administration is in many ways visibly worse than the Reagan administration is wrong, that all the, you know, everything you're seeing now was the same deal in the Reagan administration, the vitriol of a Michelle Malkin or an Ann Coulter,
yeah,
really isn't that different from the vitriol of you know, certain elements of William F. Buckley and the racism of the early National Review and so forth.
Yeah, John Chait's book The Big Con fits into this.
Yeah, there's an array of things like this. I think some of Rick Perlstein's work, which he's been doing under the rubric of the Campaign for America's Future, on the failures of conservatism, fits into it too. And it's an interesting, it's a way of, I think on the one hand there are a number of conservatives who are going to try to sort of, you know, draw a line under this era as quickly as possible.
Yes.
And say, you know, whatever that was, it wasn't conservatism.
No, it's a long-standing practice, right? When you, after you've killed the king, the job is really not done until you've polished off his kids as well. And
right.
So Bush is clearly politically dead, but that's not good enough, right? So,
well, I mean,
this is a
mop up.
This is a mop up exercise.
Well, I think that is. I give it more credit than that, even though I don't think it's quite right. I mean, it is right to say. I mean, we always put too much emphasis on individuals. So
yep.
Anything that's any story of history that's entirely about, you know, Bush, this evil guy, somehow became president of the United States and
yep.
did all kinds of bad things, which is basically my 6-year-old daughter's interpretation of the world,
yep.
is less likely to be true than one that says, you know, there are a whole array of, you know, structures of power and ideologies and things like that
sure.
that led to a series of bad results. And we're not going to let them off by just saying, we accidentally got an incompetent in the White House. So I don't view it as just a, you know, as just a power, as just an exercise of power, as in mopping up, you know, as in, you know, killing the children. I think there's a lot to it. I do think that there, at the same time, I think that there's a demonstrable, there is something different about the Reagan administration. There are a lot of things, I have a very, you know, a very, in retrospect, largely sanguine view about the Reagan administration.
And how does that compare? How does that compare to your view at the time?
I think my view when Reagan was first elected, you know, which is when I was, you know, I was 17 years old,
right.
was, you know, I had the view of a 17-year-old,
right. Yeah, okay.
which
enough.
Isn't too different from the view of a 6-year-old,
yeah.
right? Although I was a very politically savvy 17-year-old. I think my view by the end was, you know, it certainly was very different from my view of Bush.
Yeah.
It was very different from my view of Bush.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, this is a president who I mostly disagree with, and, you know, and that's it, you know, and that's fine.
Yeah.
That's very different from the way I view Bush.
I
mean, I think there were moments, you know, kind of when I went through a very apolitical phase in the middle of the Reagan administration. So when I sort of tuned back in, it's when you got into the Iran-Contra scandal and so forth, which is all very interesting. And a little bit the sort of decadent end of that administration. But I certainly didn't have the same feelings about it. And then later, as you began to see things like, you know, well, you know, I mean, after the Reagan administration, I went to work on the Hill. I worked for Bill Bradley. We were all about, you know, the whole legacy of the tax reform of 86. That was a fascinating period, and it was clearly, you know, and Bradley talked in interesting terms about how Reagan, you know, from a very different perspective, understood what they were trying to, what he and Gephardt were trying to do, and they, you know, they really did find common ground, not just the, you know, the common ground with, you know, some, a few liberal Republicans, but actually managed to integrate a set of conservative impulses with a set of liberal impulses, and that was a remarkable thing. So I've had a sort of sanguine view of the Reagan years for a long time, and I have a kind of respectful, interested view of the conservative intellectual tradition. I mean, it's something that's always interested me. I don't want to see it reduced to, you know, it was really Ann Coulter all along.
Right.
You know, well, I know how someone could make that case, but I'm not sure it's the correct case.
Well, that's the, I guess the analog here is, did Stalin follow logically and ineluctably from Lenin, or was he a monstrous aberration? And so did Bush, 43, follow inevitably from Reagan, or is he some sort of horrible aberration? And and these days there are some people trying to make the case that that this is a kind of a seamless lineage that has resulted in this sort of, you know, generally acknowledged disaster.
Right. And I mean for me that case hasn't quite been made yet. One theory I have about it, and I talk about it in this review, which is coming out in the Washington Monthly, is that in many ways, you know, a conservative government doesn't have to be incompetent. You know, it doesn't have to, you know, fire all U.S. attorneys who aren't, you know, completely loyal, or appoint, you know, completely incompetent people to run FEMA and things like that. You could have a very conservative, limited, you know, small government that was basically very competent at the things it did. The problem was that wasn't what that's not the winning ticket right now. I mean, the American people are actually looking for government that does a little more. They really did want some kind of prescription drug coverage, for example. So it's a combination of a government hostile, you know, a very hostile conservative government trying for political purposes to meet the needs of a populace that's not conservative,
and actually
not looking for that, and sort of doing it in this kind of passive aggressive way, like just giving them the most carelessly thought through junk in the form of a prescription drug plan or so forth. I'm not sure that explains everything about it, but I think that explains a little of the particular dysfunction of this administration. I don't think it explains. I mean, obviously, they brought the same careless, lack of responsibility to something they did care a lot about, which was the war. And frankly, I mean, they brought the same kind of carelessness. I mean, they really did want to privatize Social Security, but they were kind of careless about making that case or figuring out how they were going to do it or doing any of the sort of hard work about it.
I mean, that's the terrible problem of. Generalizing from the Bush administration to the broader ideology of the right is that there's just such spectacular and full spectrum incompetence and unseriousness on implementing every policy that it was identified with it just seems like such an outlier. I think that the whole Bush compassionate conservative shtick and many elements of its administration, many of the choices it wandered into, as opposed to how abominably it executed those choices, but many of the tough problems it was facing and was trying to answer do add up to a kind of crisis for conservatism, a crisis that the Bush administration ultimately didn't resolve, it just badly exacerbated. And that crisis is, I think, fundamentally one of mission accomplished. If you look at the rise of the modern right, go back to that switch from 64 to 66 and look at how an ideological movement that had resulted in just, you know, historical disaster at the polls in 1964 and seemed to be, you know, just done. How did it so quickly get back in the running and then by the 80s, you know, become not the dominant force in American political life, but certainly a powerful one, and basically dominant in agenda setting for you know, most of the past quarter century. And how did this happen? And I think it the way I see it, the rise of the right occurred in by taking advantage of several major areas where the post New Deal liberal ascendancy had failed. First, it took advantage of the explosion in crime that occurred after the mid 60s, and the perceived liberal lack of seriousness about crime and overly solicitous attitudes about due process and suspects' rights and so forth. Secondly, it took advantage of the excesses of the counterculture and the perception that liberals sympathized with these countercultural radicals and at least included them as coalition partners within the Democratic Party, so the Republicans were able to identify themselves as the party of just good old-fashioned bourgeois middle-class values and the silent majority and Joe Sixpack and all the rest, Reagan Democrats, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. The perceived fecklessness of American geopolitically after Vietnam, and the sense that liberals were no longer comfortable with leading America, leading the world. Mm-hmm. And then finally stagflation and its associated bracket creep, which elevated tax burdens across the board and created a mass constituency for cutting back government and for rethinking the kind of Keynesian political economy that had been dominant. So on all of these scores now, where are we now? Starting in the 90s, the crime rate plummeted. It's still a lot higher than it was before the mid-60s, but it went down a lot, and the sense of crisis abated. The countercultural excesses, the Democratic Party learned from its mistakes and has moved back into the cultural mainstream. And in fact, if anything, it's the GOP now that seems to be kind of on the cultural fringes with its off-putting identification with the more extreme elements of evangelical Protestantism.
Right. Well, and the culture, and the cult. I mean, what was counterculture then is culture now.
Right.
I mean,
there's been a lot of cultural change, and I talk about that in my book, The Age of Abundance. But basically, the parties have re-equilibrated to a new center, and there isn't that much distance between them on those kinds of issues. On the sort of American weakness during the Cold War, the Cold War's over, we won, and now, if anything, it's the GOP that's identified with botching a war. Mm-hmm. And then finally, on stagflation, for 25 years now, we've had 18 months of recession and no high inflation, and we all take that for granted now, and so that you don't get credit for that anymore. So basically, the bag of tricks that allowed the right to rise has been exhausted, and they haven't come up with anything else except really to pander to white working class prejudices and sort of stoke fear on that there's a terrorist under every bed and that the Mexicans are coming and gays are destroying the institution of marriage and that kind of just stoking up fear and beating people over the head with it, I think has appeal with certain large constituencies, but I don't think it doesn't get you to command the political center by any means. And then just cronyism with traditional Republican constituencies, and that'll get you money, but it won't get you it doesn't make you a majority ideology. So anyway, they haven't come up with anything new that can replace the issues that they rose to power on. But let me say, by the way, that this story is, I think, in complete conflict with the Greg Andrig, Paul Krugman story, which is that the conservatives were evil from the get-go, and the current crack-up is just the final explosion of a fall that was long in coming. In fact, I think that conservatism rose because liberalism had made some critical mistakes, and that at least in certain respects, conservatives offered better answers to real pressing problems than liberals were offering, and they reaped electoral success as a result.
Right. Well, I don't. I think that's basically correct. I mean, I think that analysis of the I mean there were errors of liberalism and there were also accidents of history.
Of course.
I mean, the, you know, the end of the Cold War was a there's the historian H.W. Brands wrote a book about the strange death of American liberalism. That's all that told in terms of the end of the Cold War.
Yeah.
How much the Cold War actually did drive a lot of what powered liberalism, including, you know, civil rights as a way of, you know, showing other nations that we were, we had to take away that card, for example, from other countries. Although that's, you know, that's one way to tell the story, certainly. It is sort of in conflict, and in a way it doesn't really matter. I mean, the amazing thing to me is that it is how difficult it is for any of the presidential, you know, if you take the, you know, this large array of presidential candidates, and you know, you take Ron Paul off to the side.
Right.
I mean, there's nobody out there thinking about anything other than take those old buttons, which, as you say, are missions accomplished, and just hit them harder and harder and harder.
Absolutely.
I mean, I read Mitt Romney's economic plan the other day, which, to his credit, I mean, it's the only actual, you know, plan of anything that's come out of any of these candidates. It's like a 20-point plan, and 13 of them are just cut this tax, cut that tax,
right.
You know, make all the Bush tax cuts permanent, then cut tax rates all across the board, then 0% taxes on all capital gains and dividends,
yep.
And then get rid of the estate tax, and then give the president a special power to cut taxes whenever he wants, and then require a supermajority in Congress for any tax increases. You know, it just goes on and on and on, and that's all there is.
Then a little bit of tax cutting.
Yeah, yeah, and that's all there is. And then, of course, Giuliani is all about, you know, can we crank up the middle class the fear of crime again? And you know, he's there's a story by Adam McGurney in the Times today about, you know, the story of New York that Rudy Giuliani tells is this, you know, dark hellhole in when he took office in 1993.
Right.
that is clearly that's. You know, he's trying to push that button again and again, but as you say, it requires not responding to current events where fear of crime is actually significantly reduced, but sort of drawing out, didn't remember how awful things were back, you know, when liberals ran the world.
Right. So
and I don't know why. I mean, Huckabee seems to be sort of slightly, you know, he has a little bit of a sense of, you know, if we're pro-family, we also ought to be thinking about the things that families need, you know, combined with very conservative social politics. That seems to me a formula that makes a little bit of sense. He's sort of got a little bit of it, but seems to be going nowhere as a presidential candidate. And
well,
it just seems to be that's one opportunity. I mean, you know, we did this event here at New America with you a few months ago, with sort of your approach to politics, and then Ross Douthat's, which is the Huckabee approach,
yes.
Basically. Either one of those seems to be like an approach you could take.
Right. So that's right. I mean, I've got no use for the Huckabee approach. It combines social conservatism, which I don't cotton to, with big government conservatism, which I don't cotton to. So,
right.
But you're right. At least it's an attempt to sort of rethink where we are, rather than just continuing to push these same buttons. But so tell me though, with Greg Andrig, what is his thesis? Why has all of this been inevitable, argument?
I mean, I think Greg's argument, which is a well worked out one. Greg's argument is, let's take conservatism as a set of tests of ideas and see how each of those ideas has worked.
Yeah.
You know, so I think sometimes that works really well. I mean, in fact, you know, I've always been basically a supporter of school choice,
mm-hmm.
and essentially saying, you know, I don't want to. Well, for a host of reasons that I won't get into here, I've always thought it was at least worth a much more serious experiment than had been carried out.
Yes.
Well, Greg has a, you know, a chapter on that. He says, you know, basically we've been doing this experiment in school choice, and not only do people, not only does it not really work out, but the people who are advocating it really, really have no interest in finding out whether it works or not, whether it works either for the kids who do move to private school or whether it actually, whether the pressure of competition improves public schools, which is really all I care about. Because, you know, it's only going to be – it's never going to be more than 10 or 15% that are actually going to move to private schools. And you know, he basically says, you know, if you think this is a good idea, you got to deal with the fact that even the people who advocate it don't want to see a serious experiment with it. And he kind of runs through, you know, how deregulation has worked out in practice. And then he really the part of the book that's interesting to me and that I'm not certain about is certain aspects of the Bush administration where he says, look, this wasn't just you know, the Bush administration power grab of say using signing statements or the unitary executive theory or any of these things. I mean, these are deeply, this isn't just like George Bush and Dick Cheney being bad. This is deeply rooted in a set of theories that came out of the Federalist Society over 20 years that have their that are as much a part of conservatism as school choice or tax cutting is, and we can look at them as and see the consequences. And so what Greg's arguing for is a kind of very very much a kind of pragmatic approach to government, which is to say, you know, it's a set of experiments, see what works, keep doing that, don't do the other thing.
Yeah, and
which is appealing.
Yeah, it's certainly a pose that liberals love to take, that they are the empirical pragmatists and the conservatives are the sort of ideology besotten, you know, radicals. And so let's just take school choice. I'm prepared. I've never had extravagant expectations for what school choice mm-hmm. might accomplish. Just basically because I think family background and community background have a lot more influence over how people turn out than schools can, and so to expecting schools to sort of remake people and that kids come in and for 6 or 7 hours a day and that they can be treated as tabula rasas and turned into something that they doesn't cohere with all the rest of their life, it strikes me as unrealistic. And so study after study shows that tweak just about everything you can on education, and it's just still socioeconomic status that determines educational outcomes rather than anything you do with schools being class size or just budgets or whatever. It's the leverage of education to influence life outcomes is fairly limited. And so the idea that school choice, that some you know, conservatives and libertarian school choice advocates think that it's going to utterly revolutionize education, I think is probably wishful thinking. I do, as a libertarian, I think that pretty much as an article of core faith, that competition works better than monopoly. And I consider that an incredibly robust principle. And right. So just in the nature of things, I would expect that schools that have to compete with each other for students to do a better job and to do a more cost-effective job than schools that have captive student bodies. So right. On that basis, I think it's better than the structure we have today. But of course, there's pie-in-the-sky promises. But to say that only conservatives are uninterested in the outcome just strikes me as laughable, because certainly the interest groups that block school choice initiatives with every fiber of their being, they don't give a damn about conducting a dispassionate experiment and seeing how it turns out. They want to kill this thing in its tracks.
Right. Well, that's the nature of being an interest group, you know, which is if your interests are those of teachers in the public school, you're an interest group,
yes,
period.
And liberal ideologues who demonize school choice advocates as people who are anti-kids and anti, you know, so anyway,
right.
there's plenty of... Right. There's plenty of water for interest groups going on.
That may be, but I'm a liberal ideologue who doesn't do that. School choice advocates. I think that modesty is right. I mean, I look at it as, I mean, one of the ways I look at school choice is that every place I've ever lived, you know, where I grew up in New York, here in Washington, when you see a school where there are kids who clearly have an exit option.
Yep.
Of private school, and the school starts to think, how do we keep these kids here? That school improves.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a bizarrely good seventh grade education because it happened in that school as opposed to my elementary school, that there were a bunch of kids who, you know, might go to private school, and the principal wanted to show the higher ups, these kids don't. These kids actually stay in this school, and as a result, I learned some Latin and European history and all kinds of stuff in seventh grade. And so I think that's actually, we have sort of natural experiments with that. But that's getting too deep into the issue. The more literal experience with school choice, they haven't shown much of anything at all. Not met the extravagant promises. But I think people can pose as pragmatists, but you do have to have some reaction to results. I mean, this goes back to the Reagan versus Bush. Bush thing. I mean, one of the interesting aspects of the Reagan administration was when things didn't work out the way they planned.
Right, they changed.
When the tax cuts of 81, produced much bigger deficits than they had predicted, they turned around and accepted tax increases. I mean, they raised taxes more often than they cut them, because they were actually based. I mean, there was an ideological vision that was kind of bounded by experiments with bounded by an appreciation of reality, and I don't want liberals to disclaim ideology totally. I mean, there's that, to me the downfall of liberalism does begin with that kind of technocratic illusion, and when I write my book, I want to trace it to Kennedy's speech, 1962 Yale commencement, where he says, all the problems of our world are no longer problems of grand ideologies. They're technical problems to be solved by experts, and that arrogance actually is a downfall in itself. So you want the sort of clarity of vision of an ideology, and understand that your ideas are actually contested ideas. That they're not just this is the way the world works. To appreciate that Keynesian, you may be a Keynesian, but to understand that Keynesian economics is one approach, and other people may disagree with you, but so that's sort of what you, the ideology you assume, and then you do adjust. If that solution doesn't work in a particular situation, you have to have enough awareness to adjust, and that to me is the difference between the Reagan era and the current round of conservatism.
Yeah,
losing that ability to adjust, and maybe there's an absolute parallel in the '60s with liberalism.
Rather than a kind of a simple morality play about how wicked ideas ultimately led to results that everybody can see are horrible, it seems to me like a good old-fashioned story about the corruptions of power, and how it played out in particular is how the rise to power occurred. That this group started out as a small insurgency with just sort of despised by the sort of cultural gatekeepers and the intelligentsia and the media and academia, eventually clawed its way to complete dominance in American political life. It held the White House and both houses of Congress, and it appointed 7 of the 9 Supreme Court justices, and held a clear majority of state houses and state legislatures. I mean, the GOP had been remade in the image of conservatism, and the GOP was now the boss party in the United States, and it had,
right.
And it clawed its way to the top with a big chip on its shoulder, and then once it got in power, the Lord Acton's dictum kicked in, and it kicked in a particular way of a complete arrogance about ignoring negative feedback, because they had to ignore so much negative feedback along the way that then when they got in power and were unconstrained by actually having to deal with an opposition that could push back effectively, they just made one horrendous mistake after another. With Reagan, he's got the White House, he's got one House of Congress. But he's got an entrenched liberal opposition. He's got much less freedom of maneuver, and I think he's just a different guy, and he's got different people around him, and that matters a lot. But But basically, I think that the GOP's problems are problems of a party that got full of itself by controlling all the reins of power, and then because of its peculiar rise to power, having a complete failure to change course when things weren't going well.
Well, there are only two things I would say about that. One is, it wasn't, I mean, there is a way to tell that story of, you know, the mythology of the remnant, and you start with Albert J. Knock and William F. Buckley,
right.
And they're this little, you know, they're this, you know, hated, ignored little group of nothings. But in fact, there was always, you know, the economic powers of this country,
yeah.
who hated FDR and all that. So they weren't just like, you know, they weren't just like the ancient Christians hiding in the catacombs.
No, that's
there.
Right. But big business was.
They did hold the economic power.
Yeah,
but they added to that, when they added into the GOP the always conservative power that happened to be within the Democratic Party but was a deeply conservative force that actually did hold back liberal government for many, many decades, when you folded that in with the, you know, traditional economic power, you had to cut some deals that were complicated deals to cut, particularly between economic and social conservatism.
Yep.
But once you folded that in, that's when you had all that. It was all there, but for some reason it was kind of broken up between two parties, and there were complexities to it. So I don't buy. I mean, the sort of rise from absolute nothing is a great myth that conservatives like to tell themselves. I don't think it's the whole.
Fair enough. So of course the GOP didn't rise from nothing. We're a two-party
right.
system. We got ins and outs, and they never go below much. You know, 40% is about the minimum. Goldwater ducked right below it. So did McGovern. But that's
right.
Basically you put a sack of flour up there and call it the major party nominee, it's going to get 40% of the vote.
I think they're trying that.
Yeah.
I think sack of flour wants to be in the next debate.
I think it would be a distinct improvement over the field. I understand what's going on with the Krugman and Chait and Anrig books. I understand wanting to stigmatize conservatism and thereby rejuvenate or revitalize liberalism. I understand all that as a kind of a partisan exercise, but I have to say that just over the I understand what it feels like to be a partisan. I've been an ideological partisan, and I've, at least in the Reagan days, felt myself a right wing partisan, a sympathizer with conservatism, even though I've always had deep disagreements with a lot of what goes on under the rubric of conservatism. Nonetheless, for much of my adult life, I considered myself a conservative sympathizer. I thought that they were clearly right on the big issues I cared about, which were smaller government and more market oriented economic policy and a more hawkish foreign policy versus the Soviets. So. Because of the kind of conservatism mission accomplished thing going on, that's affected me. Second, just because of the horrible failures of the Republican Congress and the Bush administration. And then also, I think, just at the same time, writing a book of post-war American history that tried studiously to not look at issues from a partisan perspective, but look at issues where I tried to give all sides of this crazy, tumultuous time their due and tried to think about them sympathetically. Maintaining that kind of historical perspective for the couple of years it took to write the book, I think, helped me have a different attitude about political controversy than I had had before. So at any rate, I've over the past few years, I've become kind of radically departisanized. And so things that used to look one way to me and used to look sort of serious and important to me now kind of look silly. And in particular, these anti-right screeds seem to me of course, they're all smart people. Paul Krugman's a brilliant man. He won the Clark Medal for, you know, top economist under the age of 40. His analytical powers are clearly, you know, in the upper reaches of the top, you know, one percentile of the country. And yet he succumbs to this cartoonish view of conservatism as basically just cashing in on racism. That's the whole explanation for how conservatives got to power. And how do such smart people say such dumb things? The very idea that in a two-party system country, in a country that's always been characterized by a kind of mushy lack of ideological rigor and pragmatism, and so a country with the ins and the outs, two very, very broad ideological and interest group and regional coalitions, how anyone could seriously think that one of them is the party of the angels and one the party of the devils, one has a monopoly of good, one has a monopoly of evil, just seems to me kind of preposterous once you step outside of it.
Well, I think, I mean, it's interesting because for most people, you know, your book is excellent, by the way, and I highly recommend it. The experience
of
being
deep partisan. I'll show it for the cameras for our viewers there. There you go.
Sorry, what's that?
I'm showing it to our viewers right now.
Okay,
the age of abundance.
For most people, the last few years have not been an experience of being radically partisanized. It's an experience of being partisanized, and I think there's a unique quality to this period that a lot of us, you know, me included, I mean, I'm far more partisan, vastly more partisan than I was.
It depends on where you started out. I think a lot of a number of conservative and libertarian types have been, you know, have been disillusioned with the Republican Party, so they've been departisanized.
Exactly. So it does depend a little bit where you start out, and then it'll be really interesting to see where, you know, where American politics moves next.
Yep.
And of course, there are younger people who you know, and one sees this a lot in the blogosphere, whose only experience of what they've seen as the model of successful politics is, you know, Tom DeLay's congressional operation.
Yep.
and George Bush's White House. I mean, so they sort of believe that this is, you know,
Their
entire experience has been partisanized, and that's going to have an interesting effect on politics as we go forward. The only thing I would say, just in response to the set of things that you just said, I don't see these books as a partisan exercise. I mean, I think they are very serious efforts to understand what's gone on over the last, you know, 10 or 20 years, and, you know, intellectually serious efforts to do that, you know, that make a lot more sense than the single-minded focus on, you know, on George Bush's incompetence. I mean, they are an attempt to flesh out the story. Not always correct. I don't agree with them in general in all respects. Actually, I haven't read John Chait's book yet, although I have it, but the Krugman book, which I read most of over the weekend, and Greg Anrich's book and so forth. I mean, there may be stupid things said within them, but the core, I mean, they're valuable attempts to work through the history in some ways as valuable as, I mean, the we mentioned at the beginning, the Tom Edsel book and the Tom Hamburger and the other LA Times reporter, the ones from a year or so ago that posited conservative rule forever.
Yeah.
They're still interesting books. They're still interesting efforts to plumb to sort of get a deeper understanding of what's going on here. So I'm not a wholehearted defender of that approach, because I do see much more nuance and distinction in the different eras of conservatism. But let me jump from this. There's something interesting going on right now, which reflects some of this, which is the fight over the veto of the state children's health insurance program,
yep.
SCHIP program, and a lot of attention has gone to the, you know, the both the politics of it. You know, why would I saw an item yesterday that the Republicans are angry that Bush would never vetoed a single thing,
right,
when they were in power, is now forcing them to back him up on a veto of something that, you know, has 80% popularity.
Yep.
And then there's also focus on the you know, the ugliness of the back and forth over the 12-year-old who gave the Democratic response to Bush's speech, and the,
yeah,
you know, the bloggers like Michelle Malkin going after, you know, like investigating his family.
Yes.
But I want to ignore all that and, like, take the conservative case against SCHIP on its own terms.
Yes.
Which is to say, you know, a program like this, providing health insurance, shouldn't go to, you know, it should be rigorously means tested, and it should have asset tests so that if people actually own a car or own a house that has some value, you know, basically they shouldn't be getting this program. They should figure out another way to pay for that, even if it requires selling what they have. What's interesting to me about that is it seems to me like one of the great conservative accomplishments has been this coming out of welfare reform and some other things, a total shift from kind of having a social safety net, a social contract based on becoming absolutely destitute.
Yeah.
Welfare was, you know, you hit bottom, you're stuck. What, you know, Charles Murray's losing ground for one of the points it made, and was an absolutely correct point, was it's very hard to get off welfare in that situation.
Yeah.
You know, it's economically advantageous to stay on welfare rather than go to work, lose the health care you have, figure out child care. All those costs are actually great. I mean, and liberals made the same point in different terms. Folks like David Elwood made the same argument. So we built out this social safety net, which actually supports working people, that really encourages work. And so we have this, you know, the conservative thing was work and responsibility. So we have this. And SCHIP is, the fact that you don't lose Medicaid when you go off of welfare, the fact that you have, you know, sometimes continuing income support while you're working,
yeah.
The EITC, huge benefit to help make work pay at the low end. And then SCHIP as the last piece of it. And another, you know, small minor piece of that is getting rid of the asset limit so that people don't actually, you know, have to completely impoverish themselves in order to take advantage of programs or that they only kick in after people have been completely impoverished. That all seems to me part of the conservative mission accomplished that you talked about before, and there's almost like a thoughtless willingness to completely throw this accomplishment out the window in the name of something. I'm not sure what. You probably see this issue a little differently. So
yeah. So I mean, let's see. I think that clearly. The story you just told is one that I have some sympathy with. On the other hand, I stick to my guns on an ideological point, which is that put aside the kind of minimal state utopian fantasies of libertarians, where is a line that could actually be drawn in American political life today? And basically there is the distinction I want to draw is between helping people who are in sort of unique circumstances of need and as a kind of a limited occasional exception from the norm, which is the norm is that people take care of themselves, that the norm should be that people provide for their own retirement security because most people can. The norm should be that most people save for the medical exigencies of retirement because most people can. And that we should have a safety net for people who are chronically poor, but also people who have particular, you know, they're unemployed or they've had some kind of economic dislocation. And in the case of healthcare, that the poor and the chronically sick, who are people who could not participate in a functioning health insurance market, at least not with their own dollars, should be subsidized. But that, in distinction to this, is what I see and that to me is a liberal vision. That is that of basically individualism, but supplementing that with help for people in particular circumstances of need. Now, the classical liberal version of that is going to be a skimpier safety net than the sort of modern or egalitarian liberal version. But I think that there is a potential consensus on a moderate but means-tested safety net that I tried to float as a leaden trial balloon with my article on libertarians for back in the New Republic last year. Right. Anyway, and in contrast to that, I see the as a collectivist heresy, the whole universal entitlement state where everybody is included in a monolithic government system, regardless of whether they need it or not. And so the end result of those kinds of systems, Medicare, Social Security, is not any kind of redistribution from the well-off to the needy, but rather this gigantic sloshing of money from one cohort of the middle class to another without any real redistribution, or it's very difficult for people to figure out what the distributive effects of these programs are because they're so complex. But most of the money in Social Security, for example, doesn't just stays within the same income cohorts. And it just sloshes back around and makes everybody dependent on government. And I have a principled aversion to that kind of thing. And I see SCHIP as a and as extending in that direction as a you know, camel's nose under the tent to, we've got single payer for people under 65. We'll get a kind of a single payer approach for kids, and then expand it beyond the poverty line up and up. And yet, I can recognize that the optics politically are horrible for the SCHIP opponents, that they're just against sick kids. And so I think that it would be much wiser for people who hold out some hope for a more market-oriented health policy system to try to cast this debate in the larger context of an overall healthcare reform, rather than get stuck defending this one piece of ground, which I think is pretty hard to defend.
Right, right. I think it is hard to say. I mean, you sort of said at the end, well, people should take responsibility for their health insurance because they can. I mean, we don't have anything close to a health insurance market.
No, not at all.
In which people can, you know, in which people below, you know, $50,000 or whatever, even people without significant pre-existing conditions, can purchase and can reasonably purchase insurance. So
that's right. The whole system that people call the market system is, you know, just a kludged up mess.
Right. And government policy has some role in that. The unique nature of healthcare and health insurance plays some role in that. So that you, government has a responsibility to create a structure in which it's reasonable for people to do that. You know, it may be in the end that's a very expensive structure in itself, and maybe a single payer, you know, which still has certain aspects of competition in it, maybe that's the most efficient way to do it once you have government dollars. But that's in a sense, that is an issue of principle, and we do have to. It is true also that SCHIP is sort of a, you know, on the one hand, you see it as the camel's nose under the tent. On the other hand, it is also a stopgap in the absence of some larger,
yes,
you know, decision about how we're going to create a structure in which it's, you know, in which people are able to in some way obtain health insurance at a reasonable cost, and then should be expected to as a obligation of citizenship in many ways, because otherwise you're driving costs up for other people. One thing I would say about the redistribution, of course, is that, you know, social insurance is the redistributive function of social insurance is always going to be complicated to see.
Yes.
Just as the redistributive function of any insurance is going to be hard to see, because it is partly related to need at the time. So I mean, Social Security is somewhat complicated because it's you know. It's not intended to be largely redistributive. It's intended to be mildly redistributive, but it does have some significant effect, especially for people who have much lower incomes in retirement than they had when they were working. And that's a good thing about it. I
would just say that the principle of social insurance is one that I can sign on to, at least as a matter of political reality, if not as a matter of sort of utopian aspiration. I'd love to be in a world where everybody was in a position to take care of themselves, and therefore in a position to support that politically. But I think there's real social insurance and stuff called social insurance, and the whole notion of insurance is that some contingent event that comes to pass and is a risky event. And once upon a time, Social Security was social insurance, because once upon a time, turning 65 was a risky or a contingent event that didn't happen for that many people. But these days, it's not. It's everybody has an expectation of getting to that age, and so it's not an insurable event. It's something that it's just something that's going to happen in life. And I think most people have the resources, if they structure their lives properly and if the incentives are lined up for them to do so properly, to take care of themselves in a way that's much more efficient and doesn't have the deadweight losses of taxing Peter to pay Paul. So anyway, I can conceive of a social insurance function in the healthcare area, and it's how to get there from here is incredibly tough politically, but I can conceive of a system where we actually do structure legally workable markets that allow most people to provide for against the contingency of getting wiped out by big healthcare expenses, and while then allowing that the people who can't fit into that system, basically the poor or the or the low income and the chronically sick, they get the social insurance. But anyway, that's very different from a monolithic system in which everybody is assumed to be equally involved in and dependent upon a government-run program. And so we're going to be battling about this big time over the coming years, and because the commitments we've already made under our current social insurance arrangements are incredibly expensive, and they're going to get a lot more expensive as people age. And dealing with those nasty trade-offs is something that I look forward to seeing Democrats get into power and then have to deal with.
and overplay their hand, and then we're back in the cycle.
Then we can, maybe a few years from now, we can get on blogging heads again, although I'm sure it will be some sort of incredibly high-tech variant of it by then.
It won't even be us. It'll be holograms of us.
Exactly. Programmed our avatars,
programmed by Bob Wright, operating from his mountaintop.
Where liberalism went wrong doubt. And why it was doomed to do so from the start.
Right.
Mark, I think we've talked long enough, don't you?
I think so. We didn't get into any of our fun topics, but that's fun. We'll have to do it again.
Okay, very good.
You have to watch some TV, and then we'll talk about
that.
Okay,
nice talking to you, Mark.
Okay, likewise.
All right.